chapters are in Samuel, 2 Samuel. We're kind of coming close to the end of the life of David. And then two chapters from 1 Chronicles, chapter 11 and chapter 21 in 1 Chronicles. And they are the ones that are parallel to what's going on in 2 Samuel here. So we want to talk about both the mighty men of David and the census of David as well as we go into this. But as we've kind of coming into the end of David's life, one of the things I just want to kind of bring you to awareness of, and just instead of doing a lot of background coming in, is, you know, we saw David go from the humble guy, the humble shepherd. We saw him become the prideful king. And it looked like when he was being usurped by Abimelech that he was getting that all back together again. He was kind of understanding that, you know, gee, you know, I've gotten a little bit above myself here, and began to worship the Lord. But what we're going to see is that, you know, David is a man just like us. And we struggle over and over and over again with the same sins. And I remember way back, many moons ago, a lot of water under the bridge, when I first became a full-time pastor. I was the assistant pastor of a church. And then the pastor had left, and I became full-time just in his place until the church going through the transition. But the there was a vote then to take me on as a head pastor at that point because they considered others and decided, well, we just need to make a decision about Bob, what we're going to do with Bob. And at that church, you needed 80% in order to become the pastor, and I got 80.5% of the vote or whatever. It was just over the 80%. And I remember talking to one of the guys, and, you know, God gave you just enough to get you in, but not enough that you become prideful on it. And I thought to myself, yeah, I get that. But lust of the flesh, that's my struggle. Lust of the eyes, I really don't want. And pride of life, I really have never really worried about. You know, it's not really been a bother to me. Be careful whenever you think that you don't struggle in a certain area. Because what happens? Because God lets you find out you do. We're sinners. We are sinners. And we struggle over and over and over again with the same things. You know, it's kind of like, God brings it to our mind, and we deal with it. You know, we confess it. You know, we're forgiven for it. It's kind of like it's cleansed, and we're like, yeah, I feel so good about it. And then all of a sudden we do what? We struggle with the same thing again. Now, it may be in a different way. It may be in a different level. I mean, I was just talking to somebody this past week. The things that I struggle with now aren't anywhere near 30 years ago. Does that make sense? When I first got saved, I mean, they were big sins. You know, I mean, they were big. I mean, the things that I struggle with now weren't even blips on the map. I mean, they probably were, but they weren't to me. Does it make sense? And so, but we continue to struggle. And so here's David. He's continuing to struggle with his pride, okay? And really, when you get to the core of all sin is what? Me. It's me. It's all about me. It's my eyes. It's my lust of the flesh. It's my pride. It's all about me. And that's where David is struggling. He comes into it. So we want to look at, then, David, in this struggle. And the first thing we want to look at is the mighty men. We'll get to the census in a moment. In this listing of the mighty men, I don't want to just, part of it was just to go through it. But there's some things I want to bring out in this, okay? Because a lot of times when we get into these listings, they become the places where we what? You know? It's like, ah. But these listings are very important, okay? And so I want to bring out four points that we can learn from this. First of all, the record of the mighty men is important for us to understand. That there is a what? There's a record. Well, not a battle, but there's a record, okay? There is a listing, okay, that's being made of people here. And, you know, sometimes we don't, you know, I've heard about roles in the church, roles of a church and that kind of stuff, R-O-L-L-S, roles that way, roles of a church. And I'm okay with a role of church. I don't like church membership. We're all members of what? The body of Christ. If you know Jesus Christ as your Savior, you're a member of the church, quote unquote. But there is a point where, you know, so for we have a statement of commitment and accountability. Okay? And when you do that, in a sense, we have a paper that you've signed saying that you agree to with our doctrine and you want to be committed and you want to serve the assembly and you want to be held accountable. And so therefore your name gets put what? In a sense, on a role, a list. There are lists, okay? And there's nothing wrong with a list. God has what? list. Genesis chapter 5, right from the beginning, God has a what? A list. This list is a what? A genealogy. Really, what is it? What is a genealogy? It's a list of names. It's a list of names. And what we find out all the way from the beginning, all the way to the book of Revelation, that God has what? Lists of names. In fact, he's writing a book. We're told in the book of Exodus, Moses says, you know, referring to the book you have written, he says, look, if you wipe out Israel, then I want you to what? I want you to blot my name out of your book that you have written. So Moses was understood that God is keeping a what? He's keeping a record. Okay, he's writing a book, and he's keeping a record. And we see that come out in Revelation 20. Again, I'm skipping a lot of these books, okay, for time. But in Revelation 20, we have the great white throne judgment. And when we see the great white throne judgment, we see the judge there. And to the side of the judge, there are books, plural. Okay, those are the books of works. Okay, so everything I've done, everything you've done, is recorded in those books. I think I've got a whole library to myself, you know, that God says, ooh. But the blood of Christ does what? Covers it all. Isn't it amazing? I mean, it doesn't matter how many volumes are written about you. The blood of Christ covers it all. But there's also then a singular book, the book of life, the Lamb's book of life. And in the Lamb's book of life is what? A listing of names. It's all about names. There's a listing of names. God has, again, from the beginning, had lists of names. And so I think this is pretty cool. Again, you know, we can talk about all the names here, these mighty men, and we're not going to talk about all of them, okay, by any stretch of the imagination. But the thing I want you to see is how important this is, that names are important, and they are important to God. God has the details of all these guys. Now, we're only told about these mighty men here, okay, but think about the details that we're told about these guys. They're written down. The details of your life, your name, what you have done, what you are doing, your purpose in life is what? It's important to God. And you may not have it written in Second Bob, which is, you know, three books after the Revelation, okay? You know, in other words, the point is it's not in some what? Inspired book. But it is in an inspired book, yes? It is in the most important book, and that is the one that God has before his throne, okay? And the most important book, then, to be a part of is the Lamb's Book of Life. And so I would be remiss. I mean, I know you're all saved. You've been saved for thousands of years, okay? I mean, I say that tongue-in-cheek. But the reality is, it's too easy sometimes to assume what? That everybody here is a believer. But I don't know your heart, just as you don't know my heart. You can assume I'm a believer, and you hope I am. But 2 Corinthians 11 says that there are people who are workers of the devil that are parading themselves as to be ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. So I assure you that I'm not one of those. Anyways, but you don't know that. I mean, you really don't know that. You can look at the fruit of the tree of my life, right? And you can say, well, it's consistent with someone who's hopefully serving the Lord. Make sense? But in the end, you really don't know my heart, and I don't know each of your hearts. But between you and the Lord, the transaction is what? Is there. And so I just challenge you to, if your name is not written in the Lamb's Book of Life, that today is the day of salvation. Okay? So the second thing we want to look at here is the names of the mighty men. Now, this is going to become, for some of you, extremely tedious. Okay? So I'm just warning you, okay? For some of you, this is going to be extremely stimulating. Okay? So I got about 10 people who are going to, anyways. So, seriously, though, okay, I find this very stimulating. You may not, okay? Now, what we're going to find out is the importance in these names, okay, what they mean. But while I'm talking about the importance of the names, okay, and what they mean, we're not going to go through all the names. We're going to use one guy, okay, and just to talk about it. But what I want to show you while we're going through it is also the importance of interpretation and translation, okay? Because sometimes we see things and we think, oh, there's discrepancies, and really, the discrepancy is just the matter of a vowel pointing in the Hebrew that wasn't there in the original anyway, or a matter of an interpretation, okay? So there are different things that are out there. And so so I want to kind of bring that out as well, okay? So this is the passage dealing with the first of the mighty men, Yosha Basanamath, okay? Anyways, and so you can read that there. It's in, oh, that's right. We didn't have Chuck read this. So let's go to verse 8. Of chapter 23, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Josheb-Beshebeth, the Tachmonite, chief among the captains. He was called Adino the Esnite because he had killed 800 men at one time. Okay, so this is the passage. We're going to use this kind of verse here as a representative of the rest of these verses. Okay, and so that's the verse that's up here. Okay, it doesn't look as long as it does in English, does it? Okay, that's because within Hebrew, there are a lot more concepts that are put into a word. Okay, and so we have this the first part of this. We have Josheb-Beshebeth the Tachmonite. Okay, and what I want you to see, as you can see, it's sliding up here as we go. They're talking about is these words. Okay, now you got to understand the Hebrew reads from right to left, not left to right like we do. Okay, it's backwards. Actually, it's proper. If you're left-handed, you get it that this is perfect because in Hebrew, you can write without having to go over top of your letters, okay? English is not for left-handers. So I believe as a left-hander, this is inspired that God had this thing from the beginning, and you're going to find out that left-handers really are in their right mind and in the right possession of God. So anyways, so reading this backwards, okay, instead of it saying Tachmoni bet shebet yeshev, it's actually yeshev bet shebet tachmoni. So what does it mean? Well, Yeshev, can you see these letters here? This is the sheen, this is the bet. And you come into the second word, you have what? Sheen and bet. Now, this bet that's in the front, that's a prefix, okay? That's a preposition, okay? In Hebrew, they use letters as prepositions, and they put them on the front of a word as a prefix. And when that happens, if it's a yod, generally in the beginning, the yod drops off, and the bet comes into its place. And so that totally confused you, okay? So sorry about that. But you can see the yod is right here. So you have yod, sheen, bet. Well, this bet is a preposition. It's a locative preposition. So you guys that are English kind of people, this is all your realm. You're eating this up, okay? It's a locative preposition. It means in or to, okay, that concept, okay, or upon. And so when that happens, when you put this here, that yod goes away, okay? So what you see is the same word, okay? And Yeshav means to sit. It's the verb, okay? Be-shevet means in the seat or the place of what? Sitting. So literally, it's to sit in the place of sitting, sit in the seat. Does that make sense? Okay? That's what his name, potentially his name, means, okay? I'm going to tell you right up front, I don't think that's his name. I think that's who he is, okay? This is really who he is. Okay, and then we have what is Tachmonite, okay, in the English, but is Tachakomi. You can see in 1 Chronicles 11:11, it's Hachmonite, okay? And again, what is there is, it's not ha, it's actually the cheth, okay? So we have, so that's why in mine, you can see I put the KH there, because that's the letter cheth, cheth, okay? It's the guttural clearing out your throat there, okay? So it's Chekomi, okay? It comes from the word chokhmah, which is wisdom. Literally, it means to have wisdom, to be skillful, to use wisdom in doing what you do, okay? It's used many times in the Old Testament, okay? So literally, this Josheb-Beshebeth the Tachmonite literally means the one sitting in the seat of the skillful, okay? That's literally what that means if you translate it, rather than just transliterate. Get it? Transliterate is when you take an English letter and you put it in the place of the Hebrew or Greek letter and you bring it over, okay? So this name here has been transliterated in our Bibles. Now, you all potentially do different versions. You got some King James, some New King James out there. You got some New American Standards out there. You got some ESVs, English Standard versions out there, okay? And what you're going to find is probably some of you guys are even got different translations coming to this. And this is why, okay? It depends on how they took this, okay? And so you can see then to sit in the seat of the skillful. Well, we have this next part, okay? Chief of the captains. It's just two words. Rosh, which is chief or head, the one who's in charge, okay? Russia comes from that, okay? It's the ones who, they sell themselves as the ones who are in charge, okay? But Rosh. And then Ha-Lashit-Shalishi, okay? Now, this is important. In the ESV, it says that he was of the three, okay? Shalishi, the word Shalishi, can literally mean three, but it can mean third in rank. And so you can see on your sermon note sheet I have this, but I have them all here, and we're not going to go through all those. You can go check this out, okay? all those places where you have these officers that are listed, it's the word shalishi, okay? And so, for example, when I was in the military, okay, I continued to raise, and I was a captain. But Rodney, what would you refer to me? Instead of just saying I was a captain, you would refer to me as an O3. I was an O3. Everybody would refer to me as an O3. What does that mean? I'm the third rank. I'm third ranking up, okay, as an officer. And so you just have, if I said I was a captain for the Navy, then I'm an O6, right? Yeah. I was on a naval air station once, and I used to say, this is Captain Corbin. Yes, sir. Anyways, then I found out I was an Army, and they were like, you dirtbag. Anyways, so, so the third ranking, okay, and that, people understand that, okay? And so in all those passages, there's no way that you'd put the word three in there, okay? So not necessarily the word three. Now, I'm not trying to make you ruin everything you've ever read about these passages. I just want you to think about what they really mean, okay? And again, as we did the Bible Institute and we went through Bible study, one of the things that we want to do is not presume that the translator translated properly, okay? That we want to be able to look at these words in their context throughout. That takes a lot of time, okay? And so, but fortunately, you can get eSword or Blue Letter Bible. They are free. You don't have to pay hundreds of dollars for it. I have eSword, so I always talk from the concept of eSword. If you get eSword, okay, you can get Hebrew Bibles, you can get Greek Bibles. You don't have to read them. You don't have to know how to read the Hebrew. I mean, I had the blessing of going to the school and to learn Hebrew and that kind of stuff, but you don't have to know how to read it, okay? You can do the studies using the Strong's numbers that are there. You can see where how the words are being used. You can look at it in multiple versions. I've got multiple versions. If you know Spanish, you can download Spanish. If you know Croatian, you can download Croatian. Whatever it is, you can download it. You can see how words are used in different languages in different ways, okay? It just means that you have to do what? Take time to study, okay? And so 2 Timothy, we're told to study or be earnest to show ourselves approved unto God, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. So I'm doing all this, again, just to hopefully tantalize your taste buds a little bit, but what's all out there, okay? And so literally, okay, and so it could mean the head or the chief of the third rank is literally what it probably could mean. So he's the one sitting in the seat of the skillful. He is the head of the third rank, potentially, okay? And so now we read, he is a Dino the Strong or Dino the Ezrite. The Esnite, okay? And so, again, we have this word who up here, okay? And this is the kind of fun thing. This is kind of helps me when I did my Hebrew memory. But it's who is he and he is she, okay? Who is he and he is she? And so when you're thinking the words, the Hebrew word who means he. The Hebrew word he is she. Who is he and he is she, okay? And so you can't say that too much now in our country because it's like, oh, you know, we're not quite sure. Anyways. But back when I was in seminary, that wasn't as big of a deal in our country. But anyway, so it kind of helped me. But who is he and he is she? So he, okay, and then we have this word adino. This is the only place this word is used, adino. Okay, now it can be derived from a certain Hebrew word, which means to be voluptuous, slender, okay. But then we have he is the heetzoni, okay. Again, the hey here, okay, is the. That's the definite article. It's going to come up in a moment, okay, when we talk about the census, okay? But that hey is very important. That's the definite article, okay? So I have here a book, but it's beyond just a book. It is what? The Bible. Make sense? So generically, it's what? A book. It's just a book. But then when I put the definite article in front of it, it becomes what? Specific. It's a specific book. It's the Bible. Okay? And so so we have he is, and there's no verb that they would throw in there when it's an equative like this. You can see it's just kind of, it just doesn't happen. And so when you have that, you put the equative verb in there. So potentially he is Adino the Etzoni. Well, what's Etzoni? It's, again, the only place it's used, but it's from etz, the root, etz is a tree, etzom is strong like a tree. So etzoni, probably, he is Adoni the what? The strong. He's strong like a what? Tree. I mean, And so if he's the head, when you think about these mighty men, okay, what would you expect of the guy who's over the third ranking of these mighty men? He's probably what? He's probably a skillful warrior, isn't he? Okay? And that's what we read in this guy, that he's sitting in the seat of the skillful, and that he is called the strong. And we're told in his feet, and we'll talk about the feet of the mighty men in a moment here, okay? But his feet specifically is that he killed 800 men at one time. This is kind of fun with what it says here. And clearly, he killed 800 men, okay? And then it says at one time. And literally, it means in one shot. So you can see it says bet pa'am echad, in a single unified movement. Unified, single unified is from echad. I can go on rabbit trails, and I got to be careful of myself. But in the Shema, okay, Deuteronomy chapter 6, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is echad. What's fun about it is, for the word echad, it talks about one unified, okay? It's not talking about singular book. But literally, we know that the Bible is what? It's a compilation of books. Get it? So it is echad. It is one comprising many. So you have echad of grape. You have a clusters of grape, okay? So when you don't necessarily have just one grape, you have a cluster of grapes. So again, in Deuteronomy 6, when we hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, Yahweh our God, Yahweh is echad. He's one. But that doesn't mean, when we talk about monotheism, okay, that there isn't then comprised within it a what? A unified structure. How cool is that, okay? Within the Hebrew language, these little things are just kind of given to us as nuggets, okay? I don't have time. Just kind of throws it in. But we're told that he killed these men in one single unified movement. Now, what that tells me, though, as well, if he is the man who is sitting in the seat of the skillful, he is Adoni the strong, and he killed 800 men in a single movement, potentially he didn't what? He didn't do them all on his own. He may have orchestrated this, or he may have done something that kind of brought the roof down, kind of like Samson when he pulled in the pillars and all those people died. Okay, so we're not told any more than this, but it was... What's exciting to me is that this is one single movement, okay, a single unified movement. So it could have comprised people in this thing, okay, but it wasn't a long process. This wasn't in over his lifetime he killed 800 guys. You know, this is one situation. It happened. This is what set him apart, that he did something, whether it was with an orchestrated event or whatever, that was able to go kill 800 of the enemy just instantaneously and got everybody's attention, okay? So from there, so that's all in the names of the mighty men. Again, just a little bit to tantalize the taste buds, kind of get you thinking about the importance of names, okay, in the Bible, to maybe look behind it, see what these names mean. We were talking about this at home, like Elijah, okay, is Eliyah, okay, Eli, E-L-I, comes from the Hebrew, it means my God, okay? So the I on the end is the letter Yod. We have some yods up here. Yeah, right there. Okay, so the Yeshav, that's a yod. And when it's put on the end of a word, it means mine. Okay, it's the suffix, okay, which it means mine. So Eli, my God, and then Jah, okay, J-A, is shrunk for Yah, who is Yahweh. My God is Yahweh, okay? Elisha, Elishua, okay, my God saves. Okay, is literally what it means. So names mean something, is what I'm trying to get you to understand, okay? Especially in the Hebrew. Sometimes in English, we call them whatever. You know, this name kind of, it's on the wind to me today, and it feels kind of good, you know? Or this many Hollywood people are named this, and I want to name my child this. Names mean something. Does it make sense? In the economy of God, names mean something. So I just want to challenge you. Hopefully, Lord willing, we're not having any more kids. So we're not going to struggle with that one. But if you have more kids, just think about what you name a child, okay? Or if it's your grandkids or whatever, what they name a child. Because names mean something, okay? So let's move on. The feats of the mighty men. Verse 10, we read about the feet of Eleazar, okay? And Eleazar says that he rose and he attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. What does that mean to you? I mean, it's fighting a long time. And you guys, you know how it is, right? You're squeezing that thing so hard because the battle is what? It's intense, you know? And you get to the end of it and you can't do what? You can't get your fingers off it. You know, his hand's stuck to the sword. Yahweh brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder. Verse 12 talks about Shema, okay? And it says, he, Shema, stationed himself in the middle of the field, defended it, and killed the Philistines. So Yahweh brought about a great victory. What I find in this, again, is just so exciting to me, again, is this balance between the works of man and the work of God, okay? That does God need us to accomplish his purposes? No, he doesn't. But he chooses to what? To use us, okay? And woe be to us when we become lackadaisical in serving the Lord. Look what it says about Eleazar. I mean, he worked what? Hard. Until what? Until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. Now, he's in there and he's fighting and he's fighting and he's fighting, okay? But look what it says at the end. And the people what? Returned after him only to what? To plunder. When the battle was going on, what happened? People ran, except for Eleazar, who stood there and fought and defended and fought against the Philistines. And when God gave them the victory, he brought about a great victory through one man. And when God did it, what did the people do? They all plundered. They all came to spoil, to take advantage. They didn't want to do the work. They just wanted to get the spoil. Yeah. Do you kind of see that in our economy today? Not a lot of people want to do the work, but a lot of people want to gain the rewards for the work. Okay? God forbid that's those who are called by his name. We ought to be those who understand God designed us and he designed us to work, and we should be willing to put our hands to the plow and to do the work. To the point where even our hands grow weary and they get stuck to the plow or stuck to the sword. Does that make sense? In the sense of the battle, we wrestle not against what? Flesh and blood. Is the battle out there today as it was back then? Yes, of course it is. And we should be not grow weary in well-doing, but we should continue to fight and to fight and to fight the great fight that's there to the point where even our sword is stuck to our hands. But I'm just like anybody else. Okay, and we talked about this during Sunday school, that the our nation struggling with entertainment industry and frivolity and amusement, and we all tend to become lazy at points. Make sense? Recreation, okay, is important. It's important for us to get rest. Okay, God said 6 days you shall what? Work, and the seventh day you shall rest. Rest is important. But as a nation, we've become beyond getting a day of rest, we've become focused on frivolity. Make sense? Okay? And so we've got to be careful to work, become people who work. What about Shema? He stationed himself in the middle of the field. In the middle of the field. He wasn't on an edge. He didn't put his back to the wall and wait for them to come. He was what? Potentially surrounded. I mean, he's in the middle of the field. We're talking about a great one of these kung fu things. And he's fighting all over the place. I mean, he's defending the field, okay? But in the end, we're told what? Yahweh brought about the great victory. The Lord brought about the great victory. In the end, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Does it make sense? I can't do them by Bob. Eleazar and Shema, they didn't do it by themselves. But they did what? Do it. Does it make sense? God gave them the strength. God gave them the victory. But they did still what? Do it. Too many times we want to sit in the pews. We don't have pews, so it's not us, right? And we want to wait for God to do the great victory, but to do it what? Without us. We want the great victory to be had without us having to put any sweat into the project. Okay? And so we've got to become committed. You younger guys, and even some of you older guys, I want to throw out a challenge to you on this, the part about the getting into the field and getting into the fray. And this is just from my own testimony, okay? I was already in the military when God called me to go into the ministry, okay? I had the potential. I was And so Carnegie Mellon, number three school in the country in computer science. I had a top degree. You know, they considered me at the Communication Electronics Board as the artificial intelligence expert. Okay, I didn't put myself as that. I found out I was that. Okay, so I had potentials to move forward. Okay, and I remember when God just putting the burden on me that it was time to go. And there were people who tried to encourage me. Oh, just go into the workforce for a while and make some money, because I could have commanded a good salary, and then put half of it aside and then, you know, serve the Lord with that or whatever. Da da da. The reality is, when God calls, you need to what? You need to go. You need to respond. And like this morning, I've shared this. God never ceases to meet my needs. Okay? Never. Never. My mom, when I went to seminary, my mom says, will you call me to let me know if you guys have a need? I said, no, Mama, I won't. I said, if we get to the point where we're eating cardboard, I'll call. I said, but here's the deal. If God places it on your heart to send me a gift or to bring me something, then listen to him, because I'm probably going to need him. And you will be the answer to the prayer, because I am trusting in him. And I've shared this. My outgo was more than my income. In my budget, I knew that my expenses were more than what my income was going to be. But we weren't going to go beyond what we felt we needed to do. When our first year in seminary, Marcia worked part-time. I didn't work at all. How does that work economically? Okay? And then we felt like she shouldn't be working. She should be home with Jessica. And so I went and I worked. Okay? And so, you know, we worked as a janitor. It wasn't a high-paying job. Okay? But God provides. Over and over and over again, God provides, God provides, God provides. So here's my challenge. Some of you, if God, I mean, we are in a dearth, a need, not our church necessarily, but the church, for godly men to be willing to serve him full-time. And it doesn't mean getting paid full-time. I mean, Corbin Home Improvements is still out there. But it means to serve full-time as a shepherd, being willing to serve the Lord and to trust that he will provide for your needs. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and what? All these things will be added unto you. God will provide. And so we need some warriors who are willing to go out into the field to fight until their hands stick to the sword. But that means that you're going to have to be committed. You're going to have to go. You're going to look for training. I'm willing to teach you in Greek and Hebrew. I'm not saying you have to have that, but I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to help you with hermeneutics. I'm willing to, that means to study how you study the Bible, the philosophies. I'm willing to help you with homiletics. That's how to present messages. To put you up front, even if you didn't want to be. And to learn how to stand in front of people and get over your nervousness. Okay? I'm not a public speaker. That people are surprised by that. I'm not. This is not. I'm a computer nerd. Okay? That's where my love is. I mean, I am, Deb, you outshone me this morning. You came in and introduced yourself to everybody. I am the guy who hides in the corner. Okay? But you do what God has called you to do, and he will empower you. He will give the victory. As long as you're willing to what? Step into the field. Does that make sense? You just got to get in the field, and God will use you in spite of you. Okay? Let's move on. Because we want to get into the census of David. Now, Chuck read this morning, chapter 24, and it's also 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Chronicles. I always do that. It's so too close. 1 Chronicles chapter 11. Okay? And the first thing we see as we go into this, we see this provocation that comes for David to get the census. Okay? Because we're told this right off the bat, okay, about this census, that again, the anger of Yahweh was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. So the first thing we see in this provocation is the anger of Yahweh, okay? That it comes from Yahweh. Why was the anger of Yahweh moved against Israel? That's a question you got to think about. I think because Israel did what David never did. Now, this is kind of rough because David did a whole lot of stuff, didn't he? And you're like, whoa, what did Israel do that David didn't do? I mean, David was an adulterer. He's a killer. What did David never do? Never turn from God, but go way, way back in the beginning. The shepherd boy who's anointed to be the king, right? So he's anointed, yes. He knew he was to be the next king, yes. And Saul wants to what? Saul wants to kill him. But what happened a couple times? Saul was brought where? Right into proximity of David. Close enough that David could have killed him. And David said numerous times, I will what? I will not touch the Lord's anointed. What has now the nation of Israel done twice? They have tried to usurp the Lord's anointed. They wanted to kill the Lord's anointed. They went out to battle against the Lord's anointed. They wanted to wipe mud. They were going to, remember, going to rope around the city and drag the city into the river. They wanted to kill the Lord's anointed. And then so then Sheba raises up after Absalom. Okay, and so I think that God is coming against them because they have rejected again, just like they did with Samuel. They've rejected the plan of God. And so remember when God says to Samuel, he says, just do what they say, because they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And so in the same way here, they've rejected Yahweh. They've rejected the reign of Yahweh, because David may be the earthly ruler, but ultimately who is the king? Yahweh. So can I prove that? I can't prove that, okay? But I think it stands the reason where it's at in context, that it kind of makes sense to me, that the anger of Yahweh, he comes, and so he provokes. Now, here's the deal. He provokes David. How does he provoke David? Okay? Well, looking to David's what? Arrogance. David already is struggling with what? Pride. It didn't take a long thing, okay? And we're going to talk about some more of this in just 1 second, how God does that, okay? But David's directive goes to Joab, okay? I want you to go out, and I want you to number all the people. Note what Joab's response is. What's Joab's counsel back? No, it's not okay. Don't do it. Don't do it. In fact, we're told that it must have been Joab and all the other of those three, of those people sitting in the seat of the wise, okay, that they come to and they try to talk David out of this. David, don't do it. May the Lord multiply us even more. Why are you going to do this evil? There's something unspoken here that is understood. It goes like an illustration. Genesis chapter 4. It starts off with, in the process of time, that Cain and Abel brought forth a what? Sacrifice. How did they know? It's just kind of, there's something that's there that we're not what? Told. But apparently Cain and Abel knew that they were so supposed to bring God a what? Sacrifice. And they knew what kind of sacrifice it was supposed to be. And that's why God didn't accept Cain's sacrifice. Does that make sense? So here we're told that there's, again, some things that were not told here, but clearly Joab and the other leaders of the army knew what? This is a no-no. This is a no-no. We are not to be counting the people. Don't do it, David. Don't do it. But David says what? Do it. And so what do Joab and the other guys do? They obey their leader. Okay? This is a hard decision here. Okay? I mean, you get into this battle of when do I obey the governing authorities and when do I don't obey the governing authorities. You know, when the governing authority is disobeying God, then I need to obey God rather than men. Okay, so but we're not told it specifically here. But for some reason, Joab and the others, they just kind of knew that this was not a wise decision. Okay, but they went and they did it because David commanded them to do it. Okay, so hold that in your thought. We're going to come back to it. But there's a third point here in the provocation. That comes from 1 Chronicles chapter 11, okay? In 1 Chronicles chapter 11, we're told that it's not 21. 1 Chronicles 21. I keep saying 11, but it's 21, yes, because 11 is the mighty men. Thank you. 1 Chronicles 21, okay? We're told in the very beginning of 1 Chronicles 21 that it wasn't Yahweh who provoked David, but it was Satan who provoked, okay? Now, here's the deal, okay? This is my day to get into the Hebrew and to say, it's really not what you think it is, okay? So, because we've read this all the time, right? It was Satan, okay? Well, the word shatan in the Hebrew is just the word adversary, okay? So, here's the deal. Remember I told you that letter hey was the definite article, and it's very important, okay? Because when it's used without the definite article, it's just an adversary. So, for example, in Numbers 22, verse 22 and 32, the angel of Yahweh, who is who? Most of the time, Jesus, is referred to as Shatan. He's the Shatan of Balaam. So would we say that he was Satan? No, I hope so. I mean, we're creating a new theology here today. No. It's the Hebrew word shaitan. It means adversary. And so he stood in the way of the donkey, and he was Balaam's adversary that day. Twice we're told that. Okay? 1 Samuel 29, verse 4. David is called the Satan, the shaitan, by the lords of the Philistines. The lords of the Philistines, when they're talking about going to battle against Israel, and David's going to come alongside them, remember, and be on the Philistine side, the lords of the Philistines sent him away. He is Satan to us. He's an adversary. Make sense? But he's not Satan. Makes sense as we refer to the name Satan. Okay? 2 Samuel 19, verse 22, David refers to the sons of Zariah as Satan. Now, that may be true. Anyways, from his perspective. Anyways, but he's referring to them as what? Adversaries. They're constantly going against what he wants. So they're his adversaries. Make sense? So whenever it is used without a definite article, the hey, it refers to an adversary. Guess what? In 1 Chronicles 21, it doesn't have a definite article. Okay? Now, when it is used with the definite article, ha-shatan, the adversary, it always does refer to Satan. So it is used in Job 14 times, and Zechariah it is used 3 times, and every single one of those times it refers to the adversary who is Satan, who we know from 1 Peter 5:8 and Revelation 12 that Satan is our what? He's our adversary, okay? He is the accuser of the brethren, okay? So he is the adversary. We recognize that. But in 1 Chronicles 21, get rid of Satan. It's an adversary. There was an adversary who came. So how then, bring all this together, how then did God in his anger provoke David to do the census? Probably one of his buddies. Remember the buddies that we've talked about over the time that have come alongside him? You know, there's the cousins and nephews and stuff like this. You know, remember, I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Oh, I hate when my brain walks away. Who came to Amnon and told Amnon to have Tamar, his sister, to come in. Oh, go ahead and do it, you know. And then Absalom goes and kills Amnon, and he comes, what was it? Was this Jonadab? Anyways, comes to David and says, don't let the king worry about it. It's just Amnon. It's like, what a friend, you know, what a guy. And so he is acting, in a sense, as an adversary at that point. So there's probably somebody who we're not told the name, comes alongside David. God is using that individual to just come alongside David, who's encouraging David to do what? To do it, to number the people. Ah, David, don't you want to know how many people there are? You can do this. Don't listen to Joab. God, those guys, they're always what? Your adversary. You've already said that they're your adversaries. And so you think about Bathsheba's grandfather, Ahithophel, thank you. Ahithophel, who was the counselor of David for a long time, but we found out that he really was what? An adversary of David. So we kind of question what his counsel was. So apparently David has another unwise counselor who's out there who potentially is acting as a what? An adversary. Make sense? So the provocation, but what does it all boil down to? It comes down into the arrogance of David. Does that make sense? If David wasn't so prideful, okay, thinking about it, he instantly would have said what? It doesn't matter. This is Yahweh's nation, not mine. He's just allowed me to be the one who has the opportunity to lead these people. It has nothing to do with me. It's like Moses. Think about Moses. I mean, he was the most meek man, we're told, that ever lived. Okay, did he struggle with pride here and there? He did. But as a whole, he understood his role in the plan of God. He was just there as a shepherd, an under-shepherd for Yahweh's people. Okay. Secondly, the condemnation. Well, first of all, we have a condemnation by David. The minute this goes on for 9 months, almost a whole year, right, that they're counting the people, they come back. And the minute he gets the number, David's heart, what? Condemns him. Okay? Well, that's biblical too, right? I mean, let's go backwards. I don't put all there. But David, we have so many times that we're told, Romans 2, 11 to 16, you have these on your sermon note sheet, okay, where we're told that even the Gentiles, okay, who don't have the law, when they do the things according to the law, they prove to themselves that there is a law. Okay, what are you talking about? We're talking about their conscience, right? That they know within themselves, and people do out there, they know when things are what? Right and when they're wrong. The sad thing is in our culture today, we are seeking to sear the conscience so that they don't, okay? Romans 14:23, if you doubt, you what? You sin. That's what it says. If you doubt, you sin. So that's to us as believers. If we do something and we're doubting whether we should be doing it or not, whether or not you could do it, to you at that moment, it is sin. Do you get it? Okay. 1 John 3:18-21. If your heart, what? Condemns you. If your heart condemns you. Talking about your relationship with before the Lord. Okay. God uses your heart, okay, to condemn us when we do things that are wrong. And if our heart condemns us, we need to do what? Confess it. We need to be seeking to make it right. Okay. So first thing we see is that the condemnation by David. But the second thing we see is that it doesn't stop God from bringing the consequences for the sin. I want you to realize that, okay? I know that 1 John 1:9, we love to quote it, you know, if you confess your sin, he is faithful just to what? Forgive you your sin and cleanse you from all unrighteousness. But it doesn't say that he will take away the what? The consequences, okay? And so God doesn't take away the consequences here. Rather, he sends Gad, the seer, to David, okay? And he gives David three options. You can be in the hands of your enemies, okay, for how long? 3 months. Three months. You can be in the hand of nature, a famine for 7 years, or you can be in the hand of God for 3 days. Okay, those are your options. What was David's choice? I'd rather be in the hand of God. Doesn't make sense. Why? I mean, I do not want to be in to the disposal of my enemies. I mean, I can't trust them. In nature, I don't want that. I'd rather fall in the mercies of God, okay, and let God do what he wants to do. And then we have the calamity itself. 70,000. When we talk about Achan, and we talk about what happened at Ai, there were 30-something men who died that day because of the sin of Achan. Could you imagine having it on your head that 70,000, and it's recorded. It's, remember, the listings, the record. 70,000 people's lives were extinguished because you wanted to count them. Because you wanted to do something, and it was even advised against. David responds then in penitence before Yahweh. And he sees the angel of Yahweh standing over the threshing floor of Araunah. And he cries out, says, God, what? Stop. This is all because of me. Let your wrath be against me and my house. But let these people, this is the heart of the shepherd. Isn't it? I mean, sometimes God has to do something really harsh to bring us back. This is the heart of the shepherd coming back. But it's taken 70,000 people for it to happen. Does it make sense? His heart condemned him. But when the options were given to him, he didn't say at that point, what? Just take it off of me. Don't take it out on the people. It's my fault. He didn't say that. He doesn't say it until when? Until 70,000 people are dead. What happens right this very moment? What does he see? He sees the angel of Yahweh. No, the angel doesn't stop. He sees the angel of Yahweh. Where does he see the angel of Yahweh? Over the threshing floor of Araunah, where is that? Near Jerusalem. Well, it's just right there. Yeah, it's actually within the context of Jerusalem. The city of David is right on the edge of Jerusalem proper. And so, it's hitting home. Do you get it? It's hitting home. It's here. And see, it's one thing when you hear about a tsunami happening over in Indonesia and 100,000 people die. That's kind of rough. Can you pass me the milk? Can you pass me the toast? Hey, did you get another slice of bacon? Oh, 100,000 people died. Oh, that's rotten. Hey, can we have a hamburger? Do you get what I'm saying? A lot of times we hear about those things at a distance, and it what? we're desensitized. We read every night. We read a thing from Prayer Line about what God's doing in the world in different countries and the needs that they have. And this is amazing that you know this group of believers needs $3,000 to build themselves a place to meet. We're talking the next phase, if we have a next phase. I mean, I already know we're talking about $1 million to $1.5 million. Not because we want to spend that much money on a building, but because they're going to want us to have 100 parking spaces, because you got to start do all the math on how much space you have. And we're going to have the detention retention pond, and we're going to have this, and we're going to have that. And then we're going to get to a building, which probably we could probably put up for $50,000, but it's going to be all the other money. But these people around the world, they just want $3,000 to put up a tin roof and some thatch. And so we've got to remember what's going on. David, it hits home. He sees it. It's there. And he cries out to God, God, spare the people. It's my fault. Take it out of me. Take it out of my family. So God sends Gad back to him and tells him to purchase the property of Araunah, the threshing floor of Araunah, where he sees the... What's so exciting about this, and we can spend more time on this, but we'll see this in weeks to come, but what's exciting about this is the threshing floor of Araunah is Mount Moriah. We'll find that out in just a couple chapters when we get into 2 Kings, okay? Or 1 Kings, sorry. We get into 1 Kings. It's Mount Moriah. This is where Abraham offered up Isaac, the exact spot. Now, do you think God behind the scenes was working a plan? Because he tells him, I want you to build the temple on the threshing floor of Araunah that you purchased. And so the temple sits exactly where Abram, or unless you're Muslim, you'd say it was Ishmael, was offered by Abraham. That's why the Dome of the Rock is where it's at. Because if you go into the Dome of the Rock, they say this is the exact spot that Abraham offered up Ishmael. I understand it was Abraham offering up Isaac. But even the Muslims believe that to that extent. And that is the third most holy spot to them in the world. Okay, Mecca and Medina, I think, are 1 and 2. And then the Dome of the Rock is the third most spot. And it's right on the Temple Mount. That's why there's such a battle over the Temple Mount. Okay, keep that in your brain as you look to the prophetic history coming in the future. The peace offerings. God says, I want you to offer up the offerings. Know what David says when he goes to Araunah, though, and he purchases the land, and he offers up the peace offerings. He's not going to do so, what? For something that costs him nothing. Okay? Again, too many times, we are like Cain, and we want to offer up the leftovers. Does it make sense? God wants the firstlings of the flock. He wants the first fruits. He wants our best. That's exactly right. And so he doesn't want the leftovers. David says, I get it. I've got to offer up, and this is me, I've got to pay the price because this is all about me. And finally, we have the prayer for the land. And the prayer for the land is what? It's heeded now. God hears the prayer for the land. And again, I'm continually reminded then by 2 Chronicles 7, if my people who are called by my name, if they will turn from their wicked ways. You know, it's us. It's like David, you know. We have this dross that's within us. And if we want God to hear and heed the prayers for the land, then we have got to turn from our wicked ways, from our sin. We need to humble ourselves before God and pretend and quit pretending like we've got it all together. We don't have it all together. We got one thing in common meeting here. We're a group of sinners saved by his grace. Does that make sense? Okay? It hasn't changed. One day, I'm going to be totally perfected in his sight. I love the passage, Brian. You know, when we're going to have the 10,000s and thousands upon thousands and every tribe and every tongue and every nation all gathering together to see the Lion of Judah, the Lamb that was slain, how exciting that's going to be. But until I get to that time, there's still dross. There's still dross. There's still sin that needs to be drawn out and to be confessed and to be changed. So, what is recorded in God's book about you? Are you listed in the Lamb's Book of Life? How much do you struggle with pride? Do you struggle too much to even recognize it? Now, I'm just saying, I mean, I told you my own part. I mean, sometimes when you have a pride issue, you're too prideful to what? To even acknowledge it, okay? If you were even had a twinge earlier, I challenge you to lay that out before the Lord, okay? Are you willing to ask God to reveal to you an area of your life that needs to be confessed, repented of, and transformed by his grace? In a few moments, we're going to pray. Will you do that? We don't have an invitation. I'm not going to ask you to come down the aisle, you know, because we believe as a whole that it's God who does the what? The work. If the Holy Spirit's been working with you and convicting you of something, I pray that in prayer you take that before the Lord. In the end, is there a need then to change the way you think and therefore the way you act? Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your goodness to us. You alone are God. There is none else. And you have recorded in your word so many details for your purpose, for your glory. Lord, I pray that you would help us to magnify you. Lord, help us to desire to be students of your word. Lord, that we would rightly handle your word and rightly divide it, that we would be ready to give an answer for the hope that's within us. Lord, I pray that you would reveal to each of us those areas of our lives that have got to be confessed and cleansed before you. Lord, help us to be ready, willing, and fervent to stand in the middle of the field and to do the work which you have ordained us to accomplish, knowing that you are the one who ultimately will give the victory. Lord, keep us, though, from presumptuous sins. Keep us, Lord, from the sins of pride, being unwilling to understand and confess those things which hold us back from perfect fellowship with you. I pray that you would be exalted in our assembly. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, 657 is cleanse me.